Welcome to Jason Louv's Ultra Culture, a podcast about consciousness, self-sufficiency, transhumanism, the environment, and the future, broadcasting from Hollywood, California. Follow us on the web at ultraculture.org. Here is your host, Jason Louv.
Okay, welcome to the first episode of the Ultra Culture podcast. I'm sitting here at the La Luz de Jesus Art Gallery in Hollywood, and we are in the back room broadcasting with science fiction author John Shirley, who is one of the most consistently provocative and challenging science fiction writers of the last several decades. He's written over 30 books and 10 screenplays, including his newest book, New Taboos, which collects both new material and talks and is out from PM Press. Book lists set about the new material that Shirley serves up the bloody heart of sick and rotting society with the aplomb of an Aztec surgeon on dexedrine. Does that sound like a good summation of what you do?
That is my favorite line from a review, except one guy who hated one of my books said he just felt that it was like depraved and over the top, and the last line of his review in Kirkus was, there are people who suck his lollipops of pain? Question mark.
Okay.
I just, you know, it was a negative thing, but I wanted to put it on book covers and stuff, and I wanted to actually make up some lollipops of pain and have that quote on it, and John Shirley's some lollipops, and just call them that.
Okay.
I'm sure there'll be a big market for that.
Excellent. So can you tell us a bit about the new book, New Taboos?
New Taboos is part of the Outspoken Authors series from PM Press, and they did Ursula K. Le Guin and Michael Moorcock and Terry Bisson and some other fine authors. And it's works that are pithy books that kind of have a lot of political impact to them, and the people are straightforwardly either progressive or in some way making some sort of political or social commentary. Yeah. And it's not in any tedious way. I mean, you know, it's all entertainment, but that's kind of where it's going. It's sort of like, some of Vonnegut's books would have fit, you know, or if they'd been doing this around the beginning of the 20th century, Upton Sinclair, you know, or in the 19th century, Charles Dickens. You know what I'm saying? It's people who are really looking around, and then they're writing fiction about what they see, and what's piquing their conscience.
Do you feel like that writing about topics with a conscience is maybe a discipline that's being lost in a more Facebooked world, and we're seeing more and more content on technical subjects and blogs, you know, tech blogs and things like that, but less and less writing on conscience and social issues, maybe? Or is it the opposite? Are people more aware of these things because of social media?
When people do talk about it, a lot of it is very abbreviated, and I mean in the worst way, because I'm thinking of people doing political commentary online, and an issue will come up 10 minutes before, and then they write a blog about it, and it's like, and three paragraphs, it's contemporary journalistic reportage online is superficial and crappy, and they don't even edit it anymore, and see, it's that's just kind of part of the tenor of social writing. It's tending into that superficiality, and it's something that you could put in a Twitter feed or something. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? And so that may be why there isn't that much direct social commentary in fiction. You know, because there's such a deterioration of thinking in fiction. Most fiction is either exploitive, or people are really they're trying to be more and more cynical or something. And really, if you, even though you're criticizing the world in something like New Taboos or my last book, Everything is Broken, or one of Terry Bisson's works, or, you know, even if you're criticizing it, really, you're it's out of an impulse that's totally not cynical. It's out of a belief that, you know, that people can make a difference and that consciousness can be raised.
Okay. So I sat down and I read the main story in the book, which is called A State of Imprisonment. And I don't want to give too much away, but it's about the private prison industry. And I was completely floored by this story. I walked away feeling horrified in a true way, because you portrayed a very real situation and a part of our society that's very, or part of our society right now that's very dark and is generally ignored, which you touch upon as well. Do you want to talk a bit about that story and what inspired it?
Just reading articles about privatized prisons and the people who fall through the cracks and get stuck in them.
Okay.
And the new debtors' prisons, which is a phrase out of the New York Times, actually.
Okay.
It's not my phrase.
What is that?
Well, I mean, people are going to prison because of their debts, really, in some places, because they've sort of tinkered with the laws. And even though theoretically you're not supposed to be able to go to prison for a debt in the United States, you can anyway.
Wow.
They say that you're committing fraud because you're not paying back. Like, you've let's say that you got a series of traffic tickets. This has happened to some people, and they're just, you know, struggling to survive, and they lose their license, but they need their car to drive to work to take care of their kids, or just to survive. So they keep driving, and then they get a couple more tickets, and they can't pay them. And you know how tickets will escalate,
right?
Interest, yes, and if people don't take care of them, they're going to get in trouble. Well, sometimes they can't. So who do you owe the money to? You owe it to the county, or you owe it to the local authority. And it's not quite the same. It's a debt, but they say basically, well, no, you're flouting the law, because the law says you have to pay this, and if it gets big enough, they will put you in jail for it, but other kinds of debts too, not just the kind that you owe to the county. If they can, some local institutions make money off putting people in jail.
Wow.
So that they can, they are looking for ways to say this category of person who owes money has to go to jail if they don't pay it, because they make money if they go to jail, because they get fees for remanding people to this, and then the jail itself or the prison itself is privatized, and there are people invested in that in the community, and so there's a kind of enhanced flow of people to these privatized jails and prisons in different places, especially in the South, New Orleans, generally Louisiana. Arizona is notorious for it, and I set my story in Arizona. And in my story, it's satirical that I'm describing the scene where in the near future, where the entire state of Arizona, except for very small tracts of land here and there, becomes one giant privatized prison. And, you know, that's not going to happen. But it's a kind of social satire to describe that scene. And it's just to kind of make people more aware of the risks, the social risks that we're running.
So that's amazing. You're saying that people have gone to, people have gone to for-profit prisons for not paying traffic tickets.
Yes, and for not paying other things too. And it's the local laws are adjusted so that it's unconstitutional to do that, because it is written into the basic laws of the land that you can't put people in prison just for debts. But, you know, they find workarounds, and there's so much money in it. And there was a famous case for one privatized prison up in the, I think it was Wisconsin, or Minnesota. There was a judge who was sending every young person to a juvenile facility, a facility for juvenile offenders.
Okay.
That was entirely privatized. Everyone who came up before him for anything, he, you know, even in a couple of cases, it was like one of them had yelled at a teacher, and the teacher had described it as battery because he used a bad word.
Okay.
The kid ended up in this jail.
For cursing, yes, at his teacher.
And
that's amazing.
It turned out that the privatized juvenile incarceration facility was, you know, it could charge the state a certain amount of money for every kid that it got. So there was, okay, a lot of money. The more kids that got in, the more they made. And since it's a private business, they don't have any inducement to let people go. If it's a publicly run prison, then nobody's actually making any cash off it. They don't have an inducement to keep people, and they do have an inducement to keep people circulating out, so that they can run more efficiently. But a place like this, they have no inducement to do anything but retain people and to keep them in there and to get more in. And it turned out they were paying, I believe, two different judges, cash under the table for every kid that they remanded to their
custody.
That's
amazing.
And the judges were caught, and happily they're in prison.
Okay.
But
in private prisons,
I don't know. I'd be interested, okay, to know. But I just think that it just goes to show how crazy it got already.
Right.
You know, this concept of privatized prisons and how inherently corrupt it is. It's something that's going to promote corruption.
Okay. And my understanding is a lot of corporations are involved in this, like Sodexo Marriott, I believe.
Yeah, there are a bunch of them.
Are there others? Or
I don't have a list, but okay, there are.
Okay.
And the one I created in my story is kind of makes fun. I called it the McCrew Corporation, but it, you know, it's based on one I was reading about. There are a bunch of corporations, and wow, some of them are very familiar. And it's just like a branch of them. I think Halliburton, you would think naturally.
But. Right. I had also read about this in The Economist a couple of years back, that they were getting a lot of illegal immigrants in these prisons. Like, people were trying to cross the border, and they were, mm-hmm, picking them up and kind of throwing them in these private prisons, yeah, forever, essentially, like,
yeah,
you were saying.
Yeah, and they have an inducement to keep them in there, and to find excuses to keep them in there. Well, you know, whether or not they tried to escape, they can say they did, and they can keep them longer. And because they get paid for it, and since it's a business, they have an inducement to keep people in and to accumulate people. And then they also have an inducement to pack people in, because there's more money to be made, and to make conditions in the prison, really minimal in terms of humane treatment.
Okay.
Because that's less overhead, and they make a bigger profit. And if you have a prison that's run with public funds, they don't really have an inducement to do it that much. They do have a budget, but they're not driven by the bottom line.
Right.
But a privatized prison is. And so they'll get away with giving the prisoners as little comfort and care as they can, especially
medical care. Have you heard of any examples of how, maybe if you can paint a picture of what that actually looks like, so people can imagine what, if you know the details of?
Well, I've heard that the ones where immigrants are kept, illegal immigrants are kept,
okay,
down near the border, they keep them over long, and they often keep whole families, and they don't provide anything for the children to do. They don't provide education for the children. They don't provide toys. They don't provide enough medical care for anybody. And until recently, they weren't also providing well-balanced meals. But then they were caught at this. And I think that this was turned around in at least one or two places. But in Arizona, it's been a problem continuously. And also there were famous cases of rotten security at these prisons.
Okay.
And, some of these people who are put in privatized prisons are genuine malefactors. They're genuine criminals who, you know, they're bank robbers. Some of them are murderers and rapists. And these prisons are really badly kept up. And if you were just like an average person, you're probably not going to be able to get out. But if you're a motivated criminal who's been around jails all their life, you know, you see the first weakness in this place. And there are many because they just rely on walls mostly, and they don't use enough personnel. And then their equipment breaks down and they don't fix it and so on. So a bunch of people escaped and they got out and did a lot of damage in Arizona. It was a notorious case a few years ago. Hmm.
Was that home invasions? Was that?
Yes, there were home invasions. And you know, that's scary in itself. If you're going to be a prison and you're going to put a rapist away, then do the job, you know? But the worst thing about it really is that they're motivated to put people in prison who probably shouldn't always be there, and to keep people for much longer than they should be. And then there have been cases where, I think it was in Louisiana, where women were being abused sexually by the jailers. Hmm. And since it was a privatized prison, there was less oversight. That's just the nature of them. I don't know why.
Well,
and I don't know why they should have less oversight. You'd think they'd have more, but they don't. Maybe it's just the culture that gestates privatized prison doesn't believe in oversight. So these things happen.
It's amazing. Yeah. So do you see this as, I guess this is in the private sector, so it's kind of on a different track than the rest of the stuff that's been going on in the country, but do you see this as maybe a shift, as part of the shift that the United States has made towards more of a security state?
Well, I think it's kind of a inadvertent security state. I think it's sort of like a deterioration of social values that allows the local bully to push people around. I think Isaac Asimov once said that he preferred a centralized state because otherwise you get the local bully and you get some warlord in some cases. But in this country, what you get are businesses and thuggish local, you know, people who are associated with big corporations, and they have their own little kleptocracies going.
Okay.
And that's, to me, that's the bigger risk. Now, you know, there people should keep, it's like the duty of citizens to be on the watch for abusive authority in a centralized government. It's going to drift that way sometimes, and we have to push back. But I don't think we're really in as much danger as people think we are in that respect. I think what the real danger is more like the corporate influence on Congress.
Okay.
Things, decisions like Citizens United that make it easier for them to manipulate the public. AstroTurfing, for example, if you know what that is, yep. You know, in media.
Do you want to cover what that is real quick for the listeners?
Well, you know, these big companies and people like the Koch brothers will create websites that are, as an example, I mean, it could also be in other media, but they'll have websites that are supposedly grassroots websites where the people are demanding that there be fewer regulations on, so that the economy can flower, you know, and they'll make it look as if it's the average person is demanding this through these different, you know, media outlets. But in fact, it's just set up by corporations to make it, to create propaganda,
right.
and to say that it's grassroots.
Right.
So I guess the term grassroots is where you get astroturfing somewhere in there.
One thing I just read is
grass.
One thing that I just read is there's apparently I don't know how real this is, but I was reading online that there is now software that corporations and apparently also the Air Force has been using to create user profiles to comment in blogs and public forums that make it look like the profile has been around for, you know, the person in the profile has been around for 2 or 3 years commenting on other blogs, and it's a real person instead of...
But it's not?
But it's not. It's a computer program.
Yeah.
Which is a particularly insidious version of astroturfing.
If that's true. It could be true. I wouldn't put it past them. There's so much manipulation of media. And, you know, it's not quite as black and white as people make it out. I mean, they'll say the mainstream media is all corrupt. Well, no, it's a mixture of stuff. But there's a general push toward, like, if you, in certain venues, obviously Fox News is the big obvious example. You know, everybody can see, except a small segment of the public can see how prejudicial it is. Others are kind of like right on the line, and they're manipulated too much, like CNN. And others are a little more objective and a little fairer. But it's not quite there yet. But I worry all the time that they're getting more and more influence over media. And the trend is to have more or fewer companies own more media outlets.
Right.
So that's a big danger because if that company has a particular political bias, then they're going to tend to hire commentators and reporters with that bias. And that's, then you have fewer and fewer people speaking out from a variety of, you know, different points of view. You have less, you know what I mean?
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. So,
well, okay. So let's take another track. Another issue that I'm seeing covered a little bit less is the environment, which you also talk about in the book. There's the text of a TED talk that you gave in Brussels, where you paint a fairly bleak picture of the ecological crisis. I recently read that the New York Times shut down their environmental desk. And I also saw a study, and shut it down from lack of interest.
Lack of interest.
And I also saw recently that Americans care less about climate change now than they have for, I believe, the last 2 decades, or may have been a different figure in the actual report. That's concerning. It's a concern of yours as well, as you write in the essay. You paint a picture of essentially a wealthy elite kind of sheltering themselves from the ecological crisis in virtual worlds while everyone else has to suffer through it. What do you see happening in the next several decades in the talk you talk about the next 40 years of the ecological crisis?
Well, that's the risk that you're going to have more, it's already that way, that a relatively few people worldwide, have kind of compressed the resources into their own control, and this is a notorious thing. And people talk about the 1%, and there is some truth in that. And I'm just afraid it'll get to be truer more. It's sort of an exaggeration now, but it could become very much truer because as global warming becomes more egregious, there will be more and more people around the world displaced by the effects of global warming. I mean, not only rising seas, but desertification and drought and the lack of availability of clean water and extreme weather of different kinds. So you'll see more and more people fleeing this sort of thing, and there'll be less and less arable land as a result. And then the people who are controlling the resources for the most part, and especially technological elites, a lot of these people out there in the world don't have access to the technology that the rest of us do and aren't as informed. I mean, they, it's getting out there, but there's still a lot of disconnection. That technological elite will tend to shelter itself through, you know, the old science fiction image was domes. I don't know if it'll be domes. I think it'll be, maybe it will be, but I think it'll be gated communities where they're just, the houses themselves are a kind of a complex, linked complex, sort of like shopping malls, and that are also living communities. And that'll take the place of domes, and they'll be kind of have as sort of almost watertight integrity and airtight integrity to protect them from the problems with the environment. And then you're going to have all these wild cards in the environment. You're going to have, of course, the acidification of the ocean. You have a vast reduction of fish stocks. So then, and a lot of people are dependent on fish. Right now, 50% of the large fish in the ocean are gone.
Hmm.
And that's right now.
I understand that almost all of you can't get fish without mercury in it now either.
Yeah, you can't really. You can get some that are a little cleaner of it than others, but you can't get it without it. The latest estimate from a climate scientist, well, actually it was a couple of years ago. They were saying we had, I think, 5 to 7 years to turn this around. And what I said in my talk was, do you think that that's going to be turned around, that that this buildup of anthropogenically created pollutants that are creating a greenhouse effect is going to be turned around in 5 to 7 years? Absurd to think it will be. It won't be. So global warming will continue apace. I sometimes think that the president is kind of like not working as hard as he might towards dealing with global warming because he has been advised that it's too late.
That's a sobering
idea. I sometimes
wonder
if that's the case, because he's not a stupid man, and he used to talk about it a great deal, so he's just trying to sort of mitigate it a little bit around the edges and prepare for the worst. But you could have a lot of social upset because of this, people being displaced because social upset. And so you'll have the people who have resources will be more and more defensive about that movement of a population and the movement of a desperate population. And so they'll use their authority to repress people more, I think. And you'll have a polarization we think we have a lot of polarization between the rich and poor now. I think it could get much, much more extreme for a while. But I don't think that condition can last. And there will be a huge social payback for that. And then eventually people will learn different. That's why my piece is called Why I'm Optimistic, Because Everything Will Be Terrible. Because I'm not optimistic about the next 50 years, but I don't think humanity will be destroyed. It'll just be sort of like World War II like Europe after World War II.
Okay.
But, you know, people will rebuild and they will find a better way to do things. And they will have learned, I think, from it. They have to.
Hmm. Well, you use the positive phrase. At the end of the essay, you use Bucky Fuller's phrase, Spaceship Earth. And then you say that we're heading towards what you call a collective progressive consciousness. So that's kind of the optimistic note that you strike in there. What did you see that looking like?
Well, first of all, I don't think it'll happen of itself. I think that people have to push for it. And I think it will arise out of catastrophe. First, you'll have the catastrophe. I'm not saying there won't be the catastrophe. But, for example, after Hiroshima, people were pretty horrified by the effects of the atom bomb. And we built bigger and bigger bombs, but really soon a consensus built that we don't want more Hiroshimas and we don't want bigger Hiroshimas and we don't want hydrogen bombs going off and we don't want nuclear winter. And, you know, the president is planning for a 2/3 reduction of American nuclear weapons now.
Okay.
And he wants to get rid of them entirely, of course, but it has to be done, you know, in tandem with other countries. We've never been in a nuclear war with anyone, but look how many people have nuclear weapons. People have learned. And I think that there is that arc of learning, and it's something similar will happen as a result of this imminent catastrophe. There are people like you, and there are a lot of other young people who are aware, you know, of these things. But also, they're looking for alternatives, and there are more of those. There is a certain amount of shallowness in a certain contingent of young people, and a lot of people get sucked into, you know, they stand around staring at their smartphones all day, and they walk into posts while they're walking along texting. But there are lots and lots of young people like you and other, and like people like my sons who are, you know, aware people and concerned and educated, and they're going to be around and they're going to find solutions.
Well, that's definitely a positive. I hope so. I hope that's true. And I see that happening. As much as I don't like Facebook and other social media, I do think it's a very powerful tool for that, as we saw in the Arab Spring and other places, you know, despite the negative effects as well. You know, people are definitely using that.
Yes, that's right. There is the value in social media. Some of it's negative and some of it's positive. Media is a double-edged sword, and the internet is a double-edged sword, and it cuts both ways, and some of it's good and some of it's going to hurt us. But there's a lot of good coming out of it, too. It also empowers people like white supremacists, you know, right, the internet. So that's the bad side. The right-wing extremists are actually more organized because of it, of different kinds, you know, anti-Semites and so on. The amazing how many people seem to have taken this idea that the Sandy Hook massacre was a conspiracy,
right,
and it wasn't
right.
real. And that's all because of YouTube videos, apparently, which any jackass can put together.
So one thing I wanted to talk about is Gurdjieff, because you have written quite a bit. You've been inspired by him. You've written about him quite a bit, and we touch on consciousness and esoteric stuff on the website. So I think it would be of interest to the readers. Do you want to talk a bit about Gurdjieff and his influence on you?
Well, I'm influenced by various teachers who specialize in mindfulness and self-remembering. And for example, the author of Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, or Alan Watts, it's a great spiritual teacher. But I probably have been more influenced, more struck by some of Gurdjieff's biggest ideas than anybody else, because I always thought that way myself. I always thought that people were asleep when they thought they were awake. I mean, when they're walking around and going about their life, they are more asleep than they realize. And I was always able to perceive that.
What does that mean practically? That it's a thing that's often said, but to be asleep or to be awake, what is that for you? What does that actually mean?
Well, there's... It's pretty clear there's a relative scale of consciousness. You know, when you're in deep sleep at night, there are degrees of sleep at night, and some degrees of sleep are different than others and heavier than others. And when you first wake up, you're not quite awake, right, in the morning, and then you drink some coffee and you're a little more awake. But what if that degree, that scale continues? And people, you know, I don't recommend psychedelic drugs, but maybe the first time I ever perceived this was on one when I was very young. I don't take drugs anymore, but people who have taken them can see that scale of consciousness. You can see that you're getting more intake or more input at a certain time than at other, you know, at that kind of time. when you're under an influence like that than at other times. It's very striking that you're getting more input. Well, you can have that same kind of variance of input without drugs. You just have to learn how through different kinds of disciplines. And you can do it in a way that's where you're really, in the master of yourself and not hallucinating or something. William James, I think, had a pretty good systematization of consciousness. I don't recall exactly how it went, but he studied that, and I think that it's not a supernatural idea or anything.
Okay.
Being more aware from one moment to the next. It's more like sort of like more frames per second. In a film, for example.
Okay.
You know, you take in more frames per second perceptually through methodologies like the Gurdjieff work or like the better Zazen methods or, the methods taught by Sufis, some of the Sufi teachers. It's just something you can discover if you look around. Like, did you ever take a walk and find that, okay, I'm walking for 10 minutes and just suddenly you find yourself at your destination and you don't remember walking there because you're familiar with the route and your body just took you there and your mind was just daydreaming the whole time.
Yes.
Well, what didn't you see on the way?
Right.
You know.
That
was one aspect of it. One type of sleeping while awake. It's, daydreaming can be kind of useful sometimes. It can be creative, but much of the time it's just sleep.
In my understanding, different spiritual teachers have talked about this as self-remembering or self-knowledge, and my understanding of Gurdjieff was that he prescribed a series of methods to essentially catch yourself when you were slipping back into an unconscious state and bring yourself back to your awareness of yourself. Is that accurate?
That's one thing. I mean, it's kind of a big spectrum of methods, but it all revolves around the work with attention so that you're turning your attention to your body, the sensations of the body, your feelings of your body. You discover that you're walking around in this body and you're barely aware of what's going on in it. It's almost as if we're walking around like robots that we aren't feeling anything most of the time. If we divide our attention enough to put some and keep it kind of in our bodies, then there's a sort of backdrop of awareness that gives us another objectivity and increases awareness of what's going on with us. We see ourselves more clearly. It's the process of self-observation is very important in it.
Okay.
But it can't be summed up in like a second. But it's kind of like, it has to do with work with attention and refinement of it.
Okay. Is there, I guess it can't be summed up in a second, but is there maybe a practical way that people could get a taste of that? Or a simple exercise people could do to maybe get a bit more of a handle on that type of self-observation?
Well, what you hear about a lot is mindfulness, and there are degrees of mindfulness, and some people are kind of new agey about it and will, talk about being mindful, and they don't really take it very far. So there are degrees of mindfulness, but that's a beginning. And what does that mean? Let's say that you're going to walk. Walks are a good place to sort of test this. You're going to walk from one corner to another. And so you say to yourself, while I walk just the length of this block, I'm not going to let my mind drift into associations or daydreams. And then you will observe. You'll discover after about 10, 15 steps, 20 steps, that you're already thinking about whether or not you fed your dog or did you call your girlfriend back or You know, did I pay that bill or whatever? And why was that guy being such a jerk to me? And, you know,
right.
So then if you happen to notice that when you set out to do it and you find yourself in that once more very quickly in that pre-associative daydreaming state, it's a bit of a shock. And you go, oh, wait, what happened? I was determined to get just from point A to point B over 5 minutes and I couldn't do it. So then when you notice that, it makes you notice how much one is unconscious in the course of one's daily life.
Okay.
To what extent we live in a dream.
So has this, taking this type of work or doing that type of self-observation work and holding that perspective, I'm curious how that's influenced, you know, your views or your career as a writer or the type of things you write about, or maybe how you, if that plays into social commentary and how you see the rest of the world when you're commenting on it.
It's inevitably going to find its way in. I, you know, maybe sort of in the background, maybe sort of symbolically. Sometimes I talk about it a little more directly. I notice more things to describe because I work on being more aware. So I notice things that then I'm able to bring into the texture of my writing. And also when you engage in self-observation, see yourself more honestly, well, that's going to help characterization and your understanding of a character because you're more honest with yourself. You see your own motivations more clearly. So I guess it's probably always going to be there to some extent. Philosophically, it has appeared in some of my books, like my novel Demons.
Okay.
It's in there. My novel The Other End, it's kind of crops up in that a lot because that's a sort of parable about the an alternate judgment day where the judgment just is like if you could make up your own judgment day, you know, what would it be like? You know, how would you run Judgment Day? And so this was mine.
So this is the one that was about kind of the apocalypse from a more left-wing perspective.
It was. It's a left-wing apocalypse, it must be admitted, yes. It's the other end. And it's not like God coming and doing this. It's something else. It's sort of like the power of consciousness in the universe.
Okay. So the question I want to end on is, if people are, as probably a lot of people who read my site may consider themselves, either struggling to be awake or consider themselves in that state, or just in the process of coming to consciousness or trying out different types of consciousness, what does it mean to be in that space where you're struggling to become conscious at a time of such crisis in the world? Where there's the things you describe in the book, where there's these ecological issues and inequality and corporate control. What does it mean for somebody who's struggling to raise themselves up in this time?
Well, in a way, it's kind of always been that situation with people who are working toward more consciousness and toward inner freedom. Is an expression you hear in the Gurdjieff work a lot. So, because a lot of it is about our mechanistic reactions to things, to life, and to one another. So when you have some degree of inner freedom, you're less mechanistic. And that's what. But look at history. You know, some say that history is a chronicle of crimes. And not exactly. There's the other side is there too. But you know, I mean, look how far we've come in a way, and yet history is just full of human misery and the Holocaust and the Crusades and on and on. People oppressing other people, and the Black Plague came too, and people survived that, and that killed, I think, 1 in 4 people in Europe, something like that. So always there's been this thread of people trying to get more inner freedom and more consciousness all through all of this privation and misery. And it'll just go on, even though there'll be catastrophic events. There'll be people who work on themselves. And when they do it inwardly. And, you know, they work on being more attentive to their own inner world. And that's really the world that matters when it comes to the struggle for consciousness. It starts there.
It reminds me of what you were saying. Reminded me of the James Joyce quote, "History is a nightmare from which I'm struggling to awake."
Well, yeah, we all are. One can individually, but, and you know, I think there are positive currents in history and in human history. The human effort to make things better. There are things do improve. We have civil rights in this country, and we didn't before. But there will always be a confrontation with the human condition.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much for speaking to me. John Turley's new book is called New Taboos, and it's out now from PM Press. John, thank you very much.
All right, man.